Grade 7 Conference, Lecture 74, Physiology, Part 13. We're continuing our journey into the eye as though we're a beam of light we're going to go in. And we first encounter the cornea, which is a part of the eye that bulges out, very connected to our skin, to everything in the periphery. And then we come to the pupil, and the pupil is often thought of, well, just an empty space, like the pupils we have in our class, especially the so-called spaced out ones, but it's a little bit more than that. We could say that the pupil is really the window. That's really where we are able to look into the brain, or as some might have it, into the soul. And we find the first of a number of muscles that are important in seeing, because seeing is, above all, an act of movement. The eye is a sensory organ, but it is also, we could say, an organ of will. Plato called it an atrophied limb. And so here's the first muscle. And what kind of muscle is it? It is a sphincter muscle. So it's right up there with the cardiac sphincter, the pyloric sphincter, and the rectum. So it's obviously connected, or has been connected, with metabolic activity. That it's connected with our processes of digestion. So we could say the eye is also a digestive organ, another thing that connects it then with the metabolic limb system, even though we would imagine the eye is the last thing in the world that would be connected with that lower aspect of our being. There it is. As we go further in, we come to the iris, which is rhythmically contracting and expanding, but now not in relation to sound like the eardrum, and not in relationship to whether the bolus is suitable to go further into our digestive system. Now it's an expansion and contraction in relationship to light and darkness, you know, helping us not over-digest too much light, helping us, however, get the light nourishment that we need when it's darker. And we have to think that Goethe said that light, or color rather, was the deeds and sufferings of light. What he said exactly was, the deeds and sufferings of light give forth color. So, not surprising, here we have the color of our eye. The iris gives us our color. And it might be interesting to students to know that blue eyes actually are colorless eyes. What we are seeing is, through this translucent iris, we are seeing the bluish coloring of the retina in the back of the eye. Depending on the degree of translucency, we're seeing it pale, we're seeing it dark, we're seeing it sparkle or not. So it's really brown eyes, black eyes, that have the real color. But it might be, and they'll start to look at each other's eyes in such a different way when they want to see if they can see the retina behind those eyes. And what Steiner said to us was that blue eyes will come about among a people over time who have to work very hard to maintain their warmth. So the metabolic life, the fuel, as it were, rising out of our metabolic system goes just to maintain the human warmth. And for that reason, it cannot bring real color to the eyes. Whereas those who come from warmer climates, over time, they too have developed, since they don't need the metabolic energy to just keep them warm, there's excess energy, And that can go into coloring their eyes. Steiner's also said that dark-eyed people are stronger and that in time they will completely dominate the world, whereas blue eyes are a kind of evolutionary zenith has been reached and blue-eyed, blonde-haired people are going to be disappearing. A little bit different from what the Nazis thought, I guess. But anyway, it's interesting to think about that. A couple of things. Number one, why do blondes have more fun? Because they have to. They know this may be their, you know, last time or next to last life on the earth with blonde hair and blue eyes. Secondly, think of all the high proportion of blonde, blue-eyed children you find in the average, at least North American Waldorf school, same in Britain as far as I could tell, and of course Scandinavia, Germany. So that's also very interesting. The weaker souls, the ones who recognize something in their incarnation cycle, will not return. They'll return, but they're never going to be in this kind of body again, very likely. They're the ones who come to us, I guess, for some consolation. Anyway, that's very interesting, but I wouldn't start to bring that to the children. Next, we come to the lens. The lens is actually a metamorphosis of the skin. So we see how the skin plays its way into our sensory organization, going kind of deeply within us in certain ways. But it is skin that has gotten so refined that it is bloodless. So there we see a part of our body that is bloodless. And that's why, for example, in cataract surgery, a person can have a synthetic lens put in and not tell the difference at all. Very different from other things that get transplanted and are rejected and so on. It's easily done. It's something of a foreign object in our body. And if you think of Hans Christian Andersen's wonderful story, The Snow Queen, he speaks of how people got pieces of glass in their eyes and they couldn't see the world correctly. Or we could also think of the crystal coffin into which the body of Snow White was placed. So there's the lens. Something that is, for all practical purposes, dead. And we are using that coffin, that corpse of our skin, to see the world, in what we believe to be a very objective way. Well, of course, for us to be objective about the world and not subjective about it, we have to die. Something has to die, so that we will not see through our blood, as happened embryologically. And here we might say we have, you know, something good for the seventh grader to hear about the way in which we are constituted, so that one part of us can come so close to being dead for the sake of objectivity, to be able to look into the world and to see it for what it is, and not for our sympathies and antipathies, coloring it all. But blood is involved with the eye, or we could say metamorphose blood, because for the lens to expand and contract, it doesn't do that itself. It needs a set of tiny muscles, very small muscles, that are around it. And the lens is very much in movement, so we have that sphincter muscle of the iris, and now we have the in the pupil, and now we have the movement of the lens. So once again, this metabolic limb quality is there as well. So the muscles are contracting and expanding, and that really helps the lens to grow rounder or more elongated. And at every portal, every step we take into the eye, we see a different configuration of muscles. So it's not surprising then that Waldorf students, who even when they're sitting down are being asked to look up at the blackboard and then at their main lesson books, to play games where they're right next to their partner and clapping hands, or where they're running across the room to knit and looking very closely at things and then looking across at the teacher, their eyes are getting a good workout, especially when they go on nature walks. And we should, you know, say, look at that far away, look at that bird flying. Oh, look what's here, look at the stone in the stream. So that the eyes, the muscles are in movement. But altogether, any movement that we have is going to contribute to the health of the eyes, and vice versa. So one can understand why in mainstream education, where there's so much sitting, and where the children are, you know, noses in a book, or more often than not, noses in the screen of a computer or a tablet, that this is really going to atrophy those eyes. Look at eighth graders in a Waldorf school, how few of them, especially among those who were there from grade one, how few of them have glasses or contact lenses. Go to your local mainstream public school, and you will see in their eighth grade how many children need corrective lenses. It's a pedagogical matter. It's not just their environment, or rather not just their heredity, that's at work there. Next, we come to the cavity of the eye, which is filled with what is called vitreous humor. Vitreous, that has something to do with the world of the stone. And anyway, why isn't it just an empty socket? Why does it have liquid in it? There's actually no simple explanation that even science can give. Physiologists will say, well, it maintains the shape of the eyeball and it supports the retina. Okay, that's a way of looking at it. You know, always sort of a functional way, but not necessarily trying to see anything deeper. Now, there's an interesting book, long out of print, unfortunately, by an anthroposophical geologist named Walter Kloos, C-L-O-O-S. And he speaks in there of this monumental work that occurred when the Simplon Tunnel in Switzerland was being dug. And they had to go very, very deeply into a mountain, which the Swiss can do really well. It was one of the great miracles of tunnel construction. And in the heart of the mountain, they found colloidal silica. That is to say, they found silica in the liquid state. Now, to find it in this colloidal state, where you sort of have its liquid and there are a very fine particular matter floating in it, you can only find that when quartz is melted, which requires temperatures at around 1,000 degrees Fahrenheit. However, within the mountain, the temperature never exceeded 120 degrees Fahrenheit. Nobody could explain that. So you have silica in the uncrystallized state, as well as silica in the crystallized state, right next to each other in the same mountain. It showed that they were discovering, really, crystals in the making, which had been thought to be a phenomenon possible only under great heat. But it could happen at, you know, not really much exceeding room temperature. And Kloos also speaks about pegmatite is also connected with these proto-minerals. Now, some of this may be familiar to you from last year's work with mineralogy. But we could say that colloidal silica is quartz in potential. It's filled with infinite possibilities for growth and form. This is what we carry within our eye. This vitreous humor is a substance that is filled with the possibility of crystallizing, of going into form. And in fact, Steiner says, not about this, but in a completely different context, that whenever we see something, what we see, if it simply went its own way through our organism, would crystallize within us, and we would, as in the fairy tale, turn to glass, like the enchanted figures. He said, however, because what we see finds its way through our metabolic system to our kidneys have the capacity of dissolving this crystallizing force and bringing it back to a liquid state. And that makes it possible then for us to maintain our life and not turn to glass. Of course, now and then, maybe you've even seen these, people have a kidney stone, and one might feel that the crystallizing forces have gotten too strong there. So very interesting. Our eye is a crystal in the making, but were that crystal to go to its final form, we would be blind, and we would, in a certain way, completely turn to glass. Now we'll go still further into the eye in our next lecture.